Welcome to the HC Insider Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the commodities sector and the people within it. I'm your host, Paul Chapman.
Today we're joined by Anton Posner, returning guest and CEO of Mercury Resources. And Anton, thanks for coming on this special bonus pod to talk about the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse in Baltimore and what that means in the short term and even the long term for the commodities world. So thanks for joining. I guess can we just start off and prior to the ship, the Dali, crashing into the bridge, what was Baltimore Port's role in the commodities world?
Sure. Yeah, and thanks for having me on again, Paul. It's industry, it's always something, and you never know what's going to happen in the next day and what we're going to be talking about on a podcast, right? So, just to dive in on Baltimore. Baltimore is just such an integral part of the not only the commodities world, but other parts of the supply chain in respect to retail goods, automobiles, right? Just about everything else. So Baltimore is just a major port for a lot of different types of goods. If we focus on the commodities sector, we're going to be talking about export coal coming out of two major facilities there, the CSX Curtis Bay Terminal and Consol Coal's CNX facility at Canton. Then it's a port, a pretty significant port for import metals and steel. On the metals side, it's a significant port for import aluminum, zinc, lead that feeds into customers that are best served via Baltimore by truck and rail coming out of the port. That in addition to it's a major lumber port, so forest products facility. Throw on top of that the container operations, right, which is all types of retail goods and everything else you can imagine that fits into a container. You have these major facilities, distribution centers that include Amazon and Under Armour and other large retail-focused businesses. So there's a hit in just about every type of sector you can imagine. I'm not even getting into the oil and liquid commodity sector, not my area of expertise necessarily, right? But impact there also. So yeah, touches just about everything.
Yeah, it does have, as you say, various product imports on the liquid side. But I guess the major story there is certainly coal, which I think the port itself accounts for some 25% of US coal exports, which are going mainly to Asia. This is mainly thermal coal we're talking about, but there's also metallurgical coal. Can you just zoom in that for a minute?
Sure. Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about that. So as I mentioned, Baltimore has two major coal export facilities, the CSX railroad facility at Curtis Bay and the CNX facility. These the coal that moves into Baltimore comes in by rail out of coal producing areas, West Virginia, et cetera. Right. So that coal that has been transported already to Baltimore is most likely, for the most part, sitting put and just waiting for the port to reopen. At this point, the alternative would be to pull the coal out of Baltimore, route it back to the river system, back to West Virginia or Ohio, where it could transfer into barges. But the cost of doing that, the time to do that, by the time coal would be transported back to the river system, it probably would just never make sense to do that. Don't think that that's going to be happening on any significant scale. Perhaps coal that had not yet left its origin point could be rerouted to the river system, and that would be going onto barges and transiting by barge down to New Orleans for transfer to ocean vessels and export. Or alternatively, your other major coal export port on the U.S. East Coast is Norfolk, Virginia. There are several facilities in Norfolk. You have Norfolk Southern Railroad's Lamberts Point facility, Kinder Morgan and Pier 9. So various facilities in Norfolk that are also primarily coal export facilities. Of course, you can imagine what the phone traffic is at this point to those Norfolk facilities. So looking at routing to Norfolk is not just as simple as just switching trains to move to Norfolk, there's a capacity issue there too. You just can't squeeze all that much into a already busy export program out of Norfolk. So there's going to be a lot of coal in Baltimore waiting for the channel to open up for export, essentially.
Yeah, and let's return to that. But I guess talking about that channel, so as I understand it, the challenge at the moment, of course, is that, of course, with the tragic recovery of those who lost their lives in this incident, it's an incredible amount of steel and ship and concrete that needs to be cleared out of this channel. And even that, at the moment, we're not getting a timeline on. Can you just give us some sense of the scale of the cleanup? Not even before we talk about rebuilding the bridge, which is going to take years.
Right. Yeah. Right now, what the Army Corps of Engineers, the Coast Guard, has announced is just a temporary channel of about 11-foot draft to allow boats that are responding to the incident in and out of Baltimore and the area to get to the scene. So these are responding craft. These are work boats, right? Floating cranes that need to get into place. So this temporary channel that's been opened for that at 11 feet, of course, is not for anything commercial. And the port remains closed at this point. It's a massive task, right? These floating cranes that have been brought in, it's not just a matter of putting the equipment down into the water and lifting what's there. There's some extremely large pieces. There needs to be cutting done to bring the pieces down to scale so that they can be lifted out of the channel. No doubt, enormous amount of scattered debris on the bottom of the channel that needs to be, so it needs to be surveyed and dealt with, and the pieces that it's going to take a lot of cleanup, right, to get all these pieces. Then you still have the situation with the ship. The dolly is still sitting there with her bow down in the silt at this point, with a big chunk of the bridge resting on her forward section, pushing down with the stern now raised as she's down by the bow. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. So we're talking weeks before there's a cleared channel to allow commercial ships in and out. I think my opinion, right, is that they're going to be working on overdrive here to get that channel opened up. You not only have the commercial aspects and the employment aspects, the port being down, you have military sealift command, Navy reserve vessels, right, that are in the port. So there's some national security implications, Coast Guard vessels, and so forth. So the effort to get the bridge cleared is complicated, right? It's beyond the scope of what's been dealt with, I think, in the United States for quite a long time, since the major incident in Tampa years ago when the Sunshine Skyway was hit.
Weeks, I mean, in reality, months before this is open, irrespective of the amount of effort that goes in. As you say, it's a big challenge and not necessarily one that's not been happened in recent memory. Returning to the commodities aspect, so what does, I mean, I guess those ships that hadn't yet made it to Baltimore, or those rail, you know, barges, wagons, so forth, hadn't gotten there, they're getting rerouted. You know, what is going on with all that stranded coal and I guess other bulk materials as well? I mean, you know, who's bearing the cost of that? What are traders doing? What kind of activity have you seen?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So each type of commodity and cargo is going to have a different answer to that question, right? As I mentioned, with the coal exports, coal that's already physically in Baltimore, I think very difficult to do much with that at this point. Getting it mobilized and moving it back to the river system or moving it to Norfolk for export is probably extremely, it is extremely costly and probably not very practical for the most part. Future coal shipments can be rerouted to the river system into barges or to Norfolk for export. Switching to the import metals side of the commodity sector, this is a commodity that's easier to deal with at this point. Metals that are already on the ground, import metals that are already on the ground. Let's take aluminum that comes from Quebec, the smelters in Quebec. Baltimore is a major import port for Quebec-produced aluminum and aluminum from other parts of the world. The aluminum that's already on the ground in Baltimore is going to be railed and trucked out of there as normal, so those operations will continue. Ships that are good, that are on the way to Baltimore, already loading, already loaded in, coming out of production locations like Quebec, can be rerouted to other ports such as New Orleans and barge up into the river system into the Midwest to handle the distribution to the end receivers and buyers for that metal. Same thing with zinc and lead. More costly for sure, because there are destinations that make far more sense via Baltimore. So barging up into the river system and into the Midwest, and not only adds weeks of extra transit time onto that trade, right? But also extra cost and transportation cost, because if they're going into Baltimore, they were going into Baltimore with that metal because it logistically made the most sense to do so. So we're seeing container ships. Of course, container ships are already routing to Norfolk, New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia as alternative ports, and just about every other major port along the East Coast. Containers can be distributed fairly easily compared to other types of goods, right? Because containers can be landed, you don't have to deal with securing inside storage space or warehousing space the way you would for more sensitive type of cargo. The containers are, of course, mini warehouses themselves. So we're seeing like CSX Railroad, for example, just announced that they're putting a dedicated train support system in place to route containers from the Port of New York, New Jersey, down to the terminals in Baltimore to feed into Baltimore. So you're seeing, and that's for containers, I think I mentioned, right? So that there, you're seeing action being taken to basically make Baltimore functional, even if it's by containers coming in by rail from other ports. And then in other cases, we're seeing container lines basically dropping the containers at these other ports and leaving it to the importers, whoever booked the containers, right, to deal with the extra cost from there. Of course, not that I'm an expert on maritime law, right? But in a force majeure situation like this, where a port is closed, the liner services, the container lines and steamship lines, right, that are moving liner cargo, have an enormous amount of leeway of what they can do and how far they have to go, if at all, to deal with a situation like this. Essentially, in a lot of cases, the terms and conditions allow, and maritime law will allow, the steamship line to drop the containers at the next practical port when the port of leading a port of destination is essentially not accessible.
I get that on the maritime side, but I guess, are we also hearing force majeure for those organizations that have coal stranded in the port, but because of the bridge collapse, they no longer have routes to market? Does that also count as well? I mean, is that a tool that you're hearing those organizations use, or are they in a different predicament?
Yeah, I haven't seen it firsthand, but I'm sure in this case that the coal exporters that have sales contracts, FOB sales contracts, or CIF contracts in place are using a force majeure declaration now to deal with basically a situation where the coal was ready to load on a vessel, ship maybe already on its way now, waiting outside of the closure. So costs are racking up, right, for that ship to now divert and have to find other business. So there are losses there. Sales contracts for delivering that coal to delivering the coal to markets overseas, right, are being frustrated as a result of the port closure. So my gut feeling is force majeure clauses in these sales contracts, not the maritime, not the shipping contracts, not the charter parties. I'm talking about the sales contracts, but the force majeure clauses in those contracts is being deployed rather liberally, shall we say, at this point, no doubt, right? As coal intended for a sale is now sitting tight.
And what reaction have we seen in the market?
We're seeing scrambling on ships. You have the entire maritime industry, right, in a free-for-all at this point. Freight market-wise, seeing Capesize vessels that typically go in to load coal in Baltimore now are diverting to other ports to pick up other cargoes. So seeing just the extensive repercussions within those Capesize market right now. As for the commercial side of what's happening market-wise, probably not. Might not be the best one for that.
Okay, so long term, obviously we've got short term market repercussions, and you know, I assume there are some traders riding to be saviors, and others that are in, you know, frantic calls trying to figure out what to do. In the short term, we're going to see a rewiring until the port is opened. Are there any longer term impacts of this, do you think, around perhaps more vulnerable ports that have smaller bridges or whatever it might be? I mean, what do you think the long-term impacts here could be?
Yeah, I think long-term impact, Baltimore is going to get back into the game within the next couple of months. We're going to see things move back towards, at least move towards normal. The missing bridge at this point is going to frustrate the truck market for sure in the Baltimore area. It's a major artery for freight that goes in and out of the port, particularly the area where Trade Point Atlantic is, Sparrows Point, which is a major facility. The long-term implications, right, for this, I would love to say that this is going to inspire infrastructure upgrades at other vulnerable bridges around the country. However, we're already seeing Congress arguing over whether or not U.S. government and the federal government should be paying for the bridge reconstruction. There was a good article, I forget which publication, a few days ago about, it was named 10 other bridges in throughout the United States that were also vulnerable to ship incidents. The bridges that have been built, more modern bridges, for example, the rebuilt Sunshine Skyway in Tampa that had a major incident, has these defending dolphins, right, or obstructions that are out in the channel or protecting the bridge support structures from ships that may lose power or out of control, right, or lose steering, so that the ships themselves can't get anywhere near the support structures. But there are a lot of bridges that do not have that kind of defense network there. Would it be great to have an infrastructure program in place to reinforce these additional critical pieces of infrastructure around the country? Yes. Yeah, do I think that the political will is there to do that? That's a whole other podcast, isn't it, Paul?
Yeah. Well, one also wonders as well, I don't want to get all conspiracy theorist here as well, but, you know, it has highlighted a critical vulnerability, right? If actually large ships were to suffer a cyber attack that would lead them to lose steering or power, whatever it might be, you know, this is a pretty quick way of shutting down some major economic drivers of the US and other countries as well, right? I mean, it's sort of shocking in the scale of the devastation of the event and the ramifications long term. It's certainly an eye opener to the critical infrastructure that most, you know, all countries have, and luckily the United States has a plethora of ports and the ability to reroute and rewire its commodity trade flows and other flows as well of goods, of course. You know, this isn't so critical, but if you're in a nation with one key estuary and port, it might be a different story.
Yeah, you know what comes to mind when you say that, with the one key port or piece of infrastructure, are the canals, right? We saw what happened with the Evergreen container ship in the Suez Canal. How it shut down. Of course, it was pretty dealt with fairly quickly, which was good, right? But the scenario that you bring up, right? Really, if something like that were to happen on a longer term, that a longer lasting effect on the canal, either canal, right? We're talking about something that could be far more, you know, more far reaching in this case. We're already seeing it with what's happening, certainly in the Red Sea with the Houthi attacks and ships having to divert around. So there are adjustments that can be made, but they're costly, right? And it's certainly contributing to inflationary measures. What's happening right now with the Red Sea and it's feeding into the Suez Canal. So, yes, a big yes on what you said, essentially. Yeah.
Well, let's hope not tested. But well, Anton, it's been great to have you back on for a bonus episode. I will put links to Mercury Resources in the show notes because you produce an excellent newsletter that I certainly follow, and I know you're a wealth of resource for your clients and for us on all matters bulk commodity shipping. So I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, big thanks for having me on again, Paul. Always ready.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to support the show, please give us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
To find out more about HC Insider and HC Group, a search and advisory firm dedicated to the commodity markets, visit our website at www.hcgroup.global. There you can find out more about our services and our offices around the world. There you can also find more content, from interviews to insight pieces to more podcasts focused on the commodity value chains. Thanks again for listening.